2 Kings chapter 5 is where I wish to invite your attention. 2 Kings chapter 5. You know, on Wednesday nights, our pastor has been talking about the ministry of Elisha. And he covered part of this a few weeks back, but I would like to, just feeling led of the Lord, to bring this message from the 5th chapter of 2 Kings. You might wonder, what in the world does 2 Kings chapter 5 and the story of Naaman have to do with Christmas? Well, maybe over the next 38 minutes, you'll figure that out. 2 Kings chapter 5. Hear the word of the Lord. Naaman, commander of the army for the king of Aram, that means Syria, was a man important to his master and highly regarded because through him the Lord had given victory to Syria. The man was a valiant warrior, but he had a skin disease, leprosy. Syria had gone on raids and brought back from the land of Israel a young girl who served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "Oh, if only my master were with the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his skin disease." So Naaman went and told his master what the girl from the land of Israel had said. Therefore, the king of Syria said, "Go, and I will send a letter with you to the king of Israel." So he went. And he took with him 750 pounds of silver, 150 pounds of gold, 10 sets of clothing. He brought the letter to the king of Israel, and it read, "When this letter comes to you, note that I have sent you my servant Naaman for you to cure him of his leprosy." When the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes and asked, "Am I God, killing and giving life, that this man expects me to cure a man of his leprosy? Recognize he is only picking a fight with me." When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent a message to the king. "Why have you torn your clothes? Have him come to me, and he will know there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and stood at the door of Elisha's house. Then Elisha sent him a messenger who said, "Go wash 7 times in the Jordan, and your skin will be restored, and you will be clean." But Naaman got angry and left, saying, "I was telling myself, he will surely come out, stand, call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the place, and cure the skin disease. Aren't Ubana and Parfer, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and left in a rage. But his servants approached him and said to him, "My father, if the prophet had told you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more should you do it when he only tells you, wash and be clean?" So Naaman went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times according to the command of the man of God. Then his skin was restored and became like the skin of a small boy, and he was clean. Pop quiz, 3 questions. How big is your God? How well do you know him? How ready are you to serve him? These are not softball questions. No, they cut to the very heart of our relationship with God, do they not? And you know, many a person who is smart, well-to-do, wealthy, powerful, and well-known has a very small view of our very big God. And that was true of Naaman. Naaman, if he had taken my pop quiz this morning, would have failed miserably. Having taken it, he would have failed miserably. Well known, yes, important, yes, wealthy, yes, powerful, yes, prestigious, yes, but doesn't have a clue who God is. But God is about to change that for Naaman. When you read about him in verse 1, his resume is remarkably impressive. Notice what is said about him. He is commander for the army of the king of Aram. Aram is the Hebrew word for the Greek word Syria. And Syria, Naaman was commander of the armies of the nation just north of Israel. And he was the chief man under King Ben-Hadad of Syria, commander of the army of the king of Syria. Number two man, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, most important military leader, well known everywhere, well known by his own king, loved by his nation, feared by other nations. So powerful was he. Notice he was a man important to his master. He was highly regarded. Why was he highly regarded by his master? Look at the next statement. Through him, the Lord had given victory to Syria. What? Victory to Syria over whom? Israel. Now, wait a minute. Why would God give victory to a pagan commander of the armies of a pagan country, Syria, that were Baal worshipers and idolaters? Why would God over and over give him military victory over his own covenant people, Israel? Why would God do that? And the answer to that question is sinful idolatry of God's people. Because the people of Israel had fallen into idolatry. Their king Jehoram, son of Ahab, and Jezebel was also a man who was an idolater. He didn't really follow his own God that he said he believed in. And so God disciplined his own people and subjugated Israel, the northern kingdom, to a man whom he gave victory to Syria over Israel. I find that remarkable. Hey, it's points off when God lets a foreign nation come in and subjugate his own people. It's points off when that happens. And so the Lord had given him victory. The man was a valiant warrior. Look at all of this on his resume. But notice his resume has a little monosyllable on it, and that monosyllable is but. But your resume looks good in many ways, does it not? But on your resume, there's a monosyllable as well. But a problem, a pain, a hurt, a burden, a victory that can't be won, battles lost. But he was a leper. Here was a man who had it all. He had notoriety, he had power. Everybody saluted him. He had servants, soldiers who were around him at every moment. Had won victory after victory, name, renowned, decorated, military hero. Number two in the nation of Syria. But he was a leper. You know, you look at your resume, and lots of good things are on that resume, things you're proud of. But on everybody's resume, everybody in this room this morning, there's a word on your resume, but single monosyllable, But in Naaman's case, he was a leper. He had an incurable skin disease. Every morning when Naaman looked in the mirror, he saw the blotches on his skin. And he knew that leprosy was an incurable disease in his time, and it meant a slow, gradual death. It might take months, it might take years, but gradually would that leprosy eat away at your skin, your fingers, your toes, your nose, your ears, until you finally succumbed to a living death. That's what Naaman had to look forward to. He would have traded all of his medals, all of his victory, all of his prestige, all of his honor, and all of his wealth just to have the clean skin of one of his soldiers. But it wasn't to be. Naaman was a leper. Now the story gets even more interesting. Verse 2, Syria had gone on raids and brought back from the land of Israel a young girl who served Naaman's wife. Now a little geography. Naaman lives in Damascus, which is in Syria. Damascus is 120 miles north of the city of Samaria, which is the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. Remember, after the death of Solomon, the nation of Israel divided. You have the southern kingdom, Judah, her capital, Jerusalem. You have the northern kingdom, Israel, her capital, Samaria. And even the people of Judah laughed at and scoffed at the people of the northern kingdom. They were the country bumpkins. And Samaria was viewed as the armpit of the nation of Israel. And yet north of Samaria, you've got the border between the northern kingdom and her king and Syria and her king. And Syria at this point in history in the 8th century had subjugated Israel. Israel was under the thumb of Syria. And everybody in Israel hated Syria. And everybody in Israel hated the general who had won his victories in their own land against God's own people, Naaman. They all hated him. And periodically, because Syria had the upper hand, they would do some raids. They would raid down into the northern kingdom, cross the border, find a little town there, kill 4, 5, 8, or 10 of the adults who were there, and take away 3 or 4 young teenage girls to be slaves and servants in the homes of those who were aristocratic in Syria. Such was the case. General Naaman and his wife, they had captured one of those raids. They captured a little Jewish girl. She's not even named. Not even named. And now she is a slave of a foreign people in Naaman's home. She serves Naaman's wife. Can you imagine? Now, what she says next is even more remarkable to me. One day she said to her mistress, "If only my master were with the prophet who's in Samaria, he would cure him of his skin disease." Does that strike you as odd? Look, I grew up 60 miles south of the border of Tennessee in North Georgia. If raiders from Tennessee, when I was a teenager, had come down into Georgia, come into my hometown, killed my parents, took me back across the border into Tennessee to be a slave in somebody's house for the rest of my life, I would be ticked off about it. I would be unlike this slave girl. I can't imagine that she has compassion on Naaman. If I were she, I would be saying, "I hope he rots to death." That would be my attitude, but not this girl, no. Somehow she had remembered there's still a prophet in Israel, and there's a God in Israel, and he is still her God. And this woman who is in captivity becomes a missionary. And she says to Naaman's wife, "If only my master were with the prophet in Israel, in Samaria, he would cure him of his skin disease. Small people play a big role in God's kingdom. She's not even named. Teenage girl. And yet, she plays a big role in God's kingdom. If only my master were with the prophet who's in Samaria, he would cure him of his skin disease. So that night at dinner, Mrs. Naaman says to Naaman, "Let me tell you what the servant girl said." And they have a conversation about it, and Naaman is excited about, there's a possibility that I'm going to be healed. And if I have to go to the armpit of Israel, to Samaria, to see a wizard, some prophet over there who can heal me, if that's true, I'm willing to do it. So the next day he goes to his own king, Ben-Hadad, tells him the story. Ben-Hadad gets excited. "Naaman, you're my number two guy. You're my number one guy. And I don't want to lose you. And if there's any hope, let's run with this thing." So the king, verse 5, said, "Go, I'm going to send a letter with you to the king of Israel." So he went. Here is Naaman and his entourage, and they leave beautiful Damascus, the pearl of the Middle East at that time, a beautiful oasis in the midst of a brown and barren desert, and they make their way to Samaria, the enemy's territory. And not only that, if you're going to get a wizard to cure you, you need to give him a gift. That was customary in the Middle East. And so he took with him 750 pounds of silver, 150 pounds of gold, 10 sets of clothing, purchased, of course, from Nordstrom in Damascus. 10 sets of clothing, 750 pounds of silver in today's market, $1.3 million. 750 pounds of silver, $1.3 million. 150 pounds of gold, $6 million. He is taking a gift of $7.3 million. On top of that, 10 of the finest made suits at Nordstrom's in Damascus as a gift to the prophet, because he's expecting big things. "I'm going to get cured of my leprosy." So he brought the letter to the king of Israel, and it read. Don't you love reading other people's mail? Of course you do. Here we get to read a letter written by King Jehoram in the 8th century B.C. Here it is. Here's the content of the letter. "When this letter comes to you, note that I've sent you my servant Naaman for you to cure him of his skin disease." Now, just stop and think for a minute about this. Here is a letter delivered by Naaman himself, the general of the Syrian army, who is the leader who had subjugated all of the soldiers and the army of Israel. Here's the number one hated guy. But because Syria is now holding Israel as a vassal kingdom, Syria is under the thumb, or Israel's under the thumb of the Syrian king. Here's the king sends his own general to enemy territory with a letter, heal him of his disease. Can you imagine what that would be like? Unbelievable. "When this letter comes, note, I've sent you my servant Naaman for you to cure him of his skin disease." When the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his clothes. This also was customary in the Middle East. When very bad news, terrible, tragic news comes, you would respond in an emotional way, which would include the tearing of your robe and your clothes. And that would tell everybody in your court, man, this must be bad news. The king is some kind of upset. He tore his clothes and then said, "Am I God? Do I have the power to kill and to make alive again? I can't do that. Does this king think I can heal a man of leprosy, which nobody can heal, a dreaded disease in our day? Incurable? No. recognize he's only trying to pick a fight with me. You see, the king interpreted this letter as a ruse, as a trick, in order to give grounds for attacking Israel once again. And so the letter is already confused, because remember what the servant girl said. What did the servant girl say to Naaman's wife? Oh, if only my master could stand where? Before the prophet who's in Samaria. But the letter doesn't say anything about that. It just says to the king, I'm sending this letter to you, my servant Naaman, for you to cure him of his skin disease. Notice how everything has gotten garbled and confused. Did you ever play the game telephone when you were in elementary school? How many of you ever played game telephone? A lot of you did. For those of you who didn't, here's the game of telephone. I used to love to play this game. The teacher would line us up, 12 or 15 or however many are in the class, lined up, either in chairs or standing, and the teacher would whisper a sentence into the first student's ear. And then that student would whisper to the next, and so on down the line. And then the final student would hear and then would announce what the first sentence was supposedly supposed to be. But the great and funny thing about the game of telephone, the sentence that was announced by the last student was nothing like the original sentence, because as it got carried on down the line, it got misinterpreted and confused, and it came out totally different. So the teacher would whisper the sentence, tonight we're going to have spaghetti and meatballs for dinner. But down here, the student would announce what they heard. The big yellow dog bit the small brown dog. I mean, there's no connection whatsoever. The game of telephone. And that's exactly what's happened here. By the time it goes from the little Jewish unnamed girl to Naaman's wife to Naaman to Naaman's king, king's letter, down to the king of Israel, everybody is confused. But there's somebody who's not confused. Verse 10, then we're told, verse 8, we're told, when Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his clothes, he sent a message to the king. Why have you torn your clothes? Come on, king. Just send him to me. I'll take care of it. And he'll know there's a prophet in Israel. How did Elisha know what's going on? Nobody ever told him anything. That's a preacher for you. God told him. Better watch out for those prophets. God had told him what was going on. And while the king is panicky, Elisha calmly says, send him to me. Just send him on down the road to my house on the outskirts of town, and he'll know there's a prophet in Israel. Now, remember that line. He'll know there's a prophet in Israel. Don't forget that line. So Naaman came with his horses and chariots and stood at the door of Elisha's house. Can you imagine? I mean, there's little Elisha's house, white frame house, on the outskirts of the armpit of Israel, Samaria. And here comes the dust cloud. And I mean, the black limousine is rolling, and the Ford F-150s carrying the treasure and the gifts behind, and soldiers in black sedans, and they all pull up at Elisha's house. Finally, the dust settles, and about all you can hear is the creak of an axle and the soldier's cough. And Naaman walks to Elisha's door, knocks on the door. For a moment, nothing happens. The door does not open. But when the door does open, it's not Elisha who comes out to bow before the great general. No, Elisha doesn't even show up. He sends one of his servants. Naaman is not used to getting this kind of treatment. Hey, If the Secretary of War with his entourage rolled up to your house to have a conversation, you're not going to send your 10-year-old son out to talk to him. And here's Naaman. What an affront. The prophet won't even come out and talk to me. Rather, he sends a messenger. And so after a period of time, the door cracks open just enough where the hook is, the latch, you know, just about that much, and out peers the messenger. And he simply says this, "Go wash in the Jordan River 7 times. The word wash means dunk. Go dunk yourself 7 times in the Jordan River and you'll be clean. Click, and the door closes. Can you imagine? Now, Naaman is not used to this kind of abuse. He can't believe it. He's stunned. Not even the prophet didn't even come out. He just sent his servant. "Go wash 7 times in the Jordan, and your skin will be restored, and you will be clean." But verse 11, Naaman got what? Angry. His pride got to him. He got angry and he left. And as he leaves, the Hebrew indicates he's kind of talking under his breath. It's out loud, but it's sort of under, he's muttering to himself. And look at what he's saying. "I was telling myself, he will surely come out, stand, call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the place, cure the skin disease." And then he gives us a geography lesson. Aren't the rivers Ubana and Parfer, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be clean? So he turned and left in a rage. He starts out in anger. He leaves in a rage. It's interesting that he talks about the rivers. The prescription the prophet gave was go wash in the Jordan River. If you've never seen the Jordan River, let me tell you about it. Picture the Trinity River. No, I'm serious. I've been there. Picture the Trinity River. The Jordan River is almost identical to the Trinity River in its dimensions. It's 90 feet across. The Trinity River is about 20 feet deep. The Jordan River is anywhere from 3 to 10 feet deep. And you want to take your family swimming, you don't go to the Trinity River. It's muddy, it's sorry, mostly grown up places, snaky. You wouldn't go to the Trinity River. The same is true for the Jordan River. It's the muddiest river you ever saw. You go down the banks, and most places where the Trinity River, where the Jordan River is in Israel, there are steep banks, 45-degree angle. Then there's all kind of brush. And finally, you get into the river, and the water is muddy. In flood stage, it's flowing like crazy. And in dry spells, it's just barely flowing because you've got water here 5 feet deep, and then you've got a little bit of 6-foot flow there, and then some more, a little bit more deeper, and it's muddy. And you step in, and it's mud up to your knees. I mean, it is no river to write home about. Go wash in the Jordan River. And Naaman says, "You got to be kidding me. That sorry river. Why, Ubana, the Ubana River where I'm from, and the Parfer River just below the Ubana River are spring-fed, clear, blue water rivers that create around Damascus an oasis with beautiful foliage and flowers. Apricots. I mean, it's a beautiful place, Damascus, compared to Samaria and compared to the Jordan River, which is nothing but a strip of muddy water. Why can't I just go in my own country? Why can't I just wash in the Parfer? Why can't I wash in the Ubana? Clean, clear rivers." No. He's mad as he can be, so he turned and he left in a rage. Preachers have that effect on you sometimes. They don't tell you what you want to hear. They tell you what you need to hear from God. And sometimes, listen, sometimes God offends the mind in order to win the heart. So Naaman is offended, and he leaves in a rage. But small people play a big role in God's kingdom. His servants approached and said, "My father," that's an honorific title. "My father," they're his servants. They are his subordinates militarily. "Sir, if the prophet had asked you to do some great thing, wouldn't you have done it? Wouldn't you have risked it? I mean, sir, if he had asked you to whistle a tune while eating soda crackers, wouldn't you have done it? How much more when he just says, go to the river and dunk yourself 7 times? How hard can that be?" Small people play a big role in God's kingdom. So Naaman, verse 14, went down and dipped himself in the Jordan River 7 times according to the command of the man of God. I wonder, when he got there, did he strip down to his skivvies before he went into the water? Did he wear his uniform into the water? I don't know. We're not told. But into the water does he go. He looks back. He sees all of his soldiers and servants looking at him, and says to himself, "I feel like an idiot." But nevertheless, he's there. He's in the water now, waist deep, chest deep. One, he dunks himself and comes up. No change. I must be crazy. Two, still no change. I feel like an idiot. Three, again, no change. This is the craziest thing. What am I doing? Four, still no cure. I feel like a Kentucky Fried idiot. I can't believe I'm doing this. Five, nothing. Six, nothing. I must be a fool. But what have I got to lose at this point? Seven, and suddenly his skin becomes like a small boy, and he is healed. 7 times dunking in the Jordan River, his skin became clean like that of a small boy. He's cured of his leprosy. Now, what does he do? From right there, that part of the Jordan River, it's 110 miles back to Damascus. But that's not what Naaman does. No, he turns west. Instead of north, he goes west, back to Samaria, 25 miles. Back to the prophet's house, back to Elisha's house. Verse 15, then Naaman and his whole company went back to the man of God. And when they got there, Elisha was sitting out on the front porch in his rocking chair. And now Naaman gets to meet him. But instead of the brash, harsh pride that led him to stomp off that porch in anger and a rage, now 5 times, not once, not twice, 5 times Naaman refers to himself in addressing Elisha. Naaman refers to himself as "your servant." Your servant has returned. Your servant this, your servant that. He stood before him. Listen to what he says. Listen. "I now know there's no God in the whole world except in Israel." Now, wait a minute. What did Elisha say to the king? "Send him to me and he'll know there's a what?" He'll know there's a what? A prophet in Israel. But Elisha didn't make himself known. And now Naaman realizes it wasn't just the power or the word of the prophet. No, it's the God who stood behind that prophet. And now Naaman understands that there is no God except the God of Israel in all of the world. Therefore, please accept my gift. Verse 16, but Elisha said, as the Lord lives in whose presence I stand, I will not accept it. Naaman urged him to accept it, but he refused. You know, some preachers would have had a hard time turning down $7.3 million and 10 new suits from Nordstrom at Damascus. They would have had a hard time saying no. Not Elisha. I don't need your money. I've got God. And now, Naaman, you understand who God is, don't you? And now, Naaman, you understand how big God is, don't you? And now, Naaman, you understand how to worship and serve that God, don't you? And the rest of the story, which we do not have time to cover today, tells us exactly that. So now, Naaman, if he were to take my three-question pop quiz, would pass with flying colors. And here are the lessons. Number one, Naaman had to learn who God is. He had to be disabused of the notions of idolatry and the false god he worshiped. He had to understand who God is, and now he knows who that God is. You know what else he knows? Because of that, he knows that the God of Israel is the God of the whole world, who not only cares about the salvation of Israel, but actually cares about the salvation of a pagan nation like Syria, even a pagan general like Naaman. That's what he knows. And he commits himself to worship that God from this day forward. That's what he knows. And number two, Naaman had to learn the lesson of obedience. The lesson of obedience. In verse 10 and again in verse 14. Naaman had to learn when God says seven, six won't do. Did you read that fine print on the prescription that Elisha gave Naaman? The prescription said, go dunk yourself in the Jordan River and you'll be healed. But there was fine print on that bottle, prescription bottle. Did you read it? That fine print which says this, may not be substituted for a generic river. Only the Jordan will do it. You want to be healed? Go to the Jordan. But I want to go to my rivers and my... You want to be healed? Go to the Jordan. You must learn the lesson of total obedience. When God says seven, six won't do. And some of you today are struggling at this Christmas season. Some of you as Christians. Because you're struggling with the lesson of total obedience. You're trying six when God has told you seven. Go all the way. Number three, humility is the key to obedience. Naaman finally humbled himself and did what the prophet told him to do. That's the key to obedience, is humility. You will never obey God until you humble yourself before God. Never will you obey Him until you humble yourself before Him. Five times, I'm your servant, Naaman. The general talking to the prophet. Your servant, sir, says to you. Humility is the key to obedience. The worm of pride is ever threatening to eat into the fruit of the Spirit in your life. You better deal with that. You better humble yourself. Humility is the key to obedience. And then finally, did you notice the golden thread that runs through this text? There's a golden thread that's repeated over and over and over again. I'll give you a hint if you missed it. It has to do with posture. Let me show it to you. Look back at verse 2. Syria had gone on raids, brought back from the land of Israel a young girl who served Naaman's wife. You see that word served there? That's a Hebrew word that has this connotation. She stood before her mistress. Now, served is a good translation, but she stood before her mistress. She said, verse 3, if only my master were with the prophet. The little preposition and word there in Hebrew has the connotation of stand before. If only my master could stand before the prophet, he would heal him. Look at verse 9. Naaman came with his horses and chariots and stood at the door of Elisha's house. Verse 11. When Elisha didn't show, Naaman got angry. I was telling myself, he'll surely come out, stand before me, and call on the name of his God. So he left in a rage. Verse 15. Naaman came back to the man of God, stood before him, and said, now I know there's no God except in Israel. Receive this gift. And verse 16, Elisha said, as the Lord lives, in whose presence I stand. Everybody in this text is standing before somebody. And they are all, from the unnamed slave Jewish girl to both the kings, Jehoram and Ben-Hadad, and everybody in between, whether they realize it or not, they all stand before God. And so do you. Do you know what the lesson is? It is learning and knowing before whom you stand. Whom do you stand before this Christmas? You stand before Him. Therefore, you can pass the pop quiz. How big is your God? How well do you know Him? How ready are you to serve Him? Now you're ready because you know, like Naaman learned, you know before whom you stand. She was only an unnamed Jewish girl who preceded another Jewish girl by 800 years. The second Jewish girl, we know her name. Her name was Mary. And Mary, we are told when the angel came, recognized that she stood in the presence of God. And God said, small lady, I've got big things for you. God uses small people to do big things in His kingdom. I don't know if that little unnamed Jewish girl may have been named Mary, but I know 800 years later, Mary gave birth to Jesus the Messiah. And because of what He did on Calvary, because of that first Christmas, what can wash away my sin? Nothing but the blood of Jesus. What can make me whole again? Nothing but the blood of Jesus. Sinners plunged, dunked beneath that flow, lose all their guilty stains. That's what Naaman has to do with Christmas. this Christmas understand before whom you stand.